This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Good morning to everyone. Thank you to Dr. Kukiana for the warm welcome and for the kind introduction. My talk today is going to be on the whole debate around return to the office. So we know that this has been becoming a key issue and is linked to the vaccination debate as well. So in terms of a roadmap of what are we talking about, first, I want to talk about this return of great or grand narratives. And why do I say great or grand narratives? Because if you see the headlines, you'll see that the headlines will talk about the great recall. You also see this shift from the great reset, which was early 2020, to the great rethink and great resignation. And I would suggest maybe the great trek. So there's the notion of these grand narratives that's explaining how the world and the world of work is evolving. And I think that's something we need to unpack a bit. Then I'll look at the current remote romance, and I'll discuss why I call it a remote romance. And then I'll wrap it up with the vaccination dilemma. I'll take it up in terms of what Imran has discussed. And what I'd like to suggest that is not just a legal debate, but there's an ethics debate as well that we need to engage with. Okay, so first start with this whole question about the return of great or grand narratives. And here I'm talking about the form of the arguments, the form of these grand narratives. And we've met grand narratives before in terms of these narratives around modernization, progress, and development. And what I'm trying to ask here, is there an implicit assumption of a homogenous world? Yes, across the globe, we're all grappling with the same pandemic and its disruptions. But it's impacting us in different ways and not the same way. It's impacted on countries, industry, and workforce segments in different ways that we need to appreciate. So there needs to be nuance in our analysis and understanding. We also need to remember the critiques of globalization and the framing of development, and also the critiques of generalizing from weird samples. What I mean by weird samples is samples based on Western-educated, industrialized, and rich and democratic populations. And the other question I did pose is that, is there a narrow focus on remote and flexible work? Are we too narrow looking at that and framing the world of work in terms of this? And do we need to take a broader lens? So there's questions for us to consider and to reflect on. Firstly, we should not see employers and employees as homogenous groups. They're very different. Secondly, we need to pay attention to different geographies and contexts, and the working conditions and circumstances of different segments of employees. Not all employees are experiencing the same circumstance, and they're not experiencing the pandemic in the same way. So generally, and I'm repeating what we all know, we need to look at geographies and spatial infrastructure and commercial and residential patterns. We analyze what's happening in the world of work and in our country. We need to look at the integration within and relationships, global supply chains, production, particularly this whole debate around global talent platforms, global talent networks, and socioeconomic stratification conditions and resource distributions and access to resources. So in South Africa, we need to look at the spatial infrastructure, commerce, and residential patterns of apartheid and the post-apartheid state. So we need to look at legacy of disadvantage and exclusion. How does this express in representativity and inclusion across occupational groups and bands? And importantly, we need to look at the digital divide, because that's one of the key things that we're not really talking around, is the digital divide when we're looking at remote work and accessibility of remote work and who can undertake remote work. So we need to appreciate that some segments of the workforce can work remotely and have more access to local and global talent markets, and other segments of the workforce may not have those options, opportunities for remote working and access to and skills for the broader talent markets. To also appreciate the pandemic and our responses to it, meaning our organizations are responding to it, and the configuration of the post-pandemic world is also evolving. So if we look at the pandemic, you know, when we started off, this is April 2020, when, as Imran said, the Disaster Act was used and regulations were put out and we went through in lockdowns. A lot of companies were looking at compliance with these regulations, looking at risk and safety, and looking at contingency plans. And then towards the middle of 2020, we saw companies that started exploring digital platforms actually seeing the potential of remote work and access to global talent. So we saw the opportunities that the digital workspace presents. And you see this whole debate around the Great Reset. And this was the key term that was used in 2020, the Great Reset, or the digital reset. And that's why I talk about grand narratives. It was almost like now all workspaces, all workforce segments are experiencing this Great Reset, whereas we know that's not true. Different workforces experience had different experience of the pandemic. And some of them couldn't work remotely. They had to be at the front lines, especially essential workers. And then towards the latter part of 2020, we saw that we're actually looking at the cost of the digital workspace. We started looking at digital fatigue, the loneliness that comes with remote work, and fragility. And so you saw a lot of HR firms and conferences looking at the need to focus on well-being and performance, to look at resilience, to address this whole notion around fragility. And now I'd like to pose a question to you. Are we at the crossroads? Are we getting snared in the binary option of, at the bottom right you can see it, return to the office or work from home? Whereas before, as earlier part of this year, we were talking about a blended workforce. We talked about those that are returning to the workplace, those who can work digitally and we'll call a digital workforce, those who will be part of the flexible workforce, and there's the gig workforce that comes into play and gig platforms. We also looked at the need to manage the different types of infrastructure, including the remote workspace, because that you need to take responsibility for as an employer as well. And there's whole debates around that. And you will look at managing both performance and well-being. So have we lost touch with these debates around managing performance and well-being and a blended workforce? Another thing that's net in this binary options, either return to office or you work from home. And I think we need to be careful about this and try to unpack it further. So why am I saying it? Well, these are kind of headlines you've seen out there in the global media. Workers are pushing back on the return to the office, and employees are quitting instead of giving up working from home. Now, granted, this is a broad global, but it applies to some segments of the South African workforce as well. So globally, we've seen debates and standoffs on the management's instruction to employees to return to office. And examples that were discussed in the media and are still discussed, Apple, Google, and others, this may be instruction for a permanent return and negotiate flexible hybrid working arrangements with some fixed days at the office. And what are the reasons that employers are suggesting for this return to the office? It includes maintaining company organization values, culture, collaboration, and innovation, as well as productivity of individuals, teams, and functions. It's just not the productivity of individuals. You can work remotely in your home space, but the organization's concerned about productivity of the teams and functions in altogether, an organization as one. So this is a survey that PwC had undertaken, and South Africa was part, a small sample of South Africa was part of this survey. Now you see on the left-hand side, this is what employees would like in terms of how often employees should be in office. And you can see there, it's 3 to 4 and 5 days that they would like employees to be. However, on the right-hand side, you see what employees are suggesting what they would like in terms of working remotely. And you see a lot of them would like to work remotely more than 2 to 4 days in a week. And you see it also in terms of how they see the purpose in the office. According to employers, these are some of the top, those are top 4 reasons. Now notice again, this whole notion of productivity, providing a space to meet with clients, collaboration, and again, as I said before, enabling our company culture. Now, if you look at employees, it's interesting how it differs slightly. Yes, they talk about collaborating, accessing equipment, meeting clients, and training career development. So there's slight nuances and differences between what employers see in the purpose of office and what employee see in the office. And again, it takes us to the point earlier I made. Are we getting stuck in binaries when we talk about just 2 options, return to the office and work from home? Or should we look at some hybrid arrangements? And also that, what does that mean when we say there's hybrid arrangements? And how does that play off? So what we're noticing globally is there's increasing employee activism and resistance to some companies and industries to the management decision regarding the site and management work. And that's important. It's just not whether they want to continue working remotely. It seems that it's now becoming questions about what is the site of work and how is work being managed. Now, again, this, given the earlier caveats on samples and populations and differential market access and bargaining power of different workforce segments. But it's interesting that you're seeing this, the site and the management of work that's been contested. For some, remote work or working from home is becoming a part of their employment value proposition. So employers are selecting to leave the organization where management is now evaluating remote working with calling employees. Hence the introduction of the term Great Resignation, in contrast to what I talked about, which was the Great Reset. And you see lots of headlines of this, the Great Resignation. So at first there was grand narrative, and now you've seen some nuance coming out in the analysis, some of the stories in the media as well, in terms of what is this Great Resignation. And perhaps we can say the Great Rethink, because maybe this is more apt. It's not a Great Resignation, but what we've seen is employers are re-looking at their careers and skill sets. Employers are reconsidering their future personal working life choices, as well as a political choice in terms of relation to their company's purpose, value proposition, and stand on socioeconomic issues. And here again, we need to say, who has the opportunity to do that? So a lot of those who had the opportunity to work remotely have had the space to reflect, to consider where they are going with their careers and how, what skills that sets they have and how they need to develop it, either for the local market or the global market. So again, yeah, we need to have nuance and appreciate who has the opportunities to think or rethink where they are in terms of a career and where they're going. So again, I'm just reinforcing the point, consider context and access to resources and the talent marketplace, whether it's global or local. And in some industries and segments, the talent demand has opportunities to select where and how to work, not all other industries. And so also consider difficult economic conditions and related retrenchments. So some talent segments of the talent workforce had to seek out work in global markets out of necessity, which tend to be remote. And some may join the digital nomad movement. So you've seen some countries are offering these visas and incentives to attract the so-called digital nomads. So you see the city of Cape Town, for example, was voted one of the best places for remote work in 2021 and is considering an e-visa program. So let's look at this whole idea of remote work and why I'm saying there's a certain romance about it. If we look at how remote work has evolved. Now we're seeing that companies with hybrid or remote work in a distributed workforce are beginning to question the nature of the employment contract. With the remote site and flexible ways of working and shift from managing time to managing outputs and outcomes, the question is the individual an employee, contracted worker, or independent contractor? What I mean by it? If you look at the defining features of an employee, it's control and direction, discretion of time and hours, being part of the organization, provision of tools and equipment, and economic dependence. Now, we've got to ask ourselves, what remote work and flexible work, is this evolving? Are companies reevaluating their employment contracts with remote work, given these changes? This also raises questions on remuneration that accounts for cost of living and the benchmarks for these. For example, you've seen, there's a quote from an article that's looking at the implications on remuneration. And what they say is more flexibility brings up another salary cap question. How will employers equitably adjust the pay of those workers choosing to remain entirely remote post-pandemic, especially live in or move to a lower cost part of the country? And in the past year, for example, Facebook and other large tech companies have said they will reduce the salaries of employees who choose to work outside of expensive hubs like San Francisco and New York. So think about South Africa, think about Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town, and think about the different salary levels and the cost of living in these different cities. Think about if someone's working remotely. Our companies are now going to look at the cost of living adjustment and also in terms of the salary packages they're offering. The other question we need to ask is, will remote full-time, part-time gig workers be subject to commodification of skills as well as automation, substitution by artificial intelligence? So at this moment, remote workers are in demand. And they may not be facing the pressure of commodification and automation that some of the blue-collar workers are experiencing. However, soon, if those tasks can be done and managed remotely, then would it make a difference if an AI machine completed the task? So, for example, someone who is an analyst, if we see the advances of AI, and I don't want to get into debates around whether it's valid or not, if there are advances of AI, would a machine be able to learn and develop the expertise of a remote worker and then substitute for that remote worker? And that's the paradox of remote and flexible working, where the choice of living and working flexibly opens the door to precarious employment and potential redundancy. So at the moment, many remote workers, especially in high scarce skills and critical skills, feel very comfortable. And you see them posting on social media that they're working in fantastic locations. A lot of people posting how they're working from an island or wherever. However, there is a paradox, because if in the future they can be substituted by AI machine, then will they also experience the same precariousness that other segments of the workforce is experiencing? And that's why I said this whole romance of the remote work, we need to be careful about and maybe think about it more carefully. There's also a cost of remote work for average full-time, part-time gig workers. And earlier I talked about digital fatigue. We also see, for example, this is a survey that was done in looking at how remote employees felt left out and ganged up by those who are working on-site. And you see many remote workers felt dislocated and disconnected to the workplace and the organization. And the other part of it is being disembodied. If you're sitting on your laptop or your PC in the four walls, and if you day on day just interacting through a screen, it impacts your well-being because as humans, we want our interactions are social, they're embodied. And if we don't have that, there are long-term impacts on that. So that's why I reference that being disembodied. So there are costs to remote work. And this is, again, we need to unpack this whole romance about remote work. Everyone is, and myself as well, appreciates the opportunities and advantages of it. But we also need to understand what are the disadvantages, what are the impacts and unintended consequences of remote work, especially for HR practitioners, because they then need to be proactive and provide interventions to address those. So, as we said earlier, we noted those questions are nature of employment contract, differential access to local and global talent markets, and the implications of capable platforms and AI platforms. Well, we need to also understand that organizations don't exist and operate in a vacuum. They are physically based in some way, and they need to consider the office, the operations, supply chains, and customer bases. And we haven't talked about it in terms of the vaccination debate, and one of the comments from the audience as well was in terms of if you market into another business, you need to consider what's their business policy in terms of how do you interact with them. So there's this whole romance about being remote in a digital workspace, but we can't forget that we're physically based. And then we need to also consider stakeholders where we are based. Okay. So we need to consider our values, culture, and collaboration, both internally in the organization and externally in terms of the stakeholders outside of the enterprise. So Mom already talked about the vaccination dilemma for the workspace. I'm not going to go to the recent direction that was provided there by the minister. What I do want to talk around is that there is a legal debate, but there's also an ethical debate that we need to consider. And I think one of it is the dilemma of the collective good and maintaining a safe working environment while providing for individual choice, which could also impact on others and operations negatively. And also, I think we need to also appreciate, especially in the academic space, that there are contestations of what is collective good and the ethics of mandatory vaccination. So whether we take a utilitarian argument in terms of ethics or a deontological argument, there are various forms of arguments around the ethics around vaccination. But also, what is the responsibility of the organization and what's the responsibility of the individual? And then, as Iman said, you know, the Constitution defines rights, but also defines limitations to rights in terms of public health. So everyone's referencing the Constitution, but we also need to understand there are limits to that. And it goes back to this question around the collective good and individual choice and individual freedom and how we balance those two. So in a nutshell, that is what I'd like to share with you. Thank you for the invitation, for sharing our thoughts. What I shared to you with today is based on a fact sheet that we had written earlier. And again, thank you again for inviting the SWP and myself. We really appreciate this engagement with the MUT.
All right, thank you very much, Doc, for the presentation and very interesting research findings where we are looking at the view of the employer and the employees in terms of what they want to do, whether they want to go back to the office or they want to work at home. Without taking too much of your time, colleagues, can I have questions, please, or comments from the audience? Yes, Rafael, over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Doctor. Mine is just a comment. I'd just like to say thank you so much for that infographic, you know, on the digital fatigue, how the remote employees, they feel left out and ganged upon on. And I think maybe this is really the time that maybe us as a university or as HR as well, we can actually embrace this and see what is, literally happening currently. So thank you, Doctor, for that infographic. I think it's really significant. It's so real to what is happening currently, I think, on our workspaces. Thank you so much.
To say, okay, Dr. Cordellani, over to you.
Thank you, Chair, and hi again, AJ.
Hi, Dr. Aiden.
Interacting with universities all the time, what has been the trend with regards to remote work at universities? And you mentioned the cost of remote work, and I think you related that to the employees. But I think there is a cost to employers as well of remote work in terms of maybe even staff turnover. Few people that I know are already working for university. There is global search for talent because there is limited talent in higher education. And already of that limited talent, there is this global search for that talent. And now you are with this remote work, with more and more universities going towards this remote work. Academics are now finding themselves having more or exposed to more opportunities. I've got two people I know already in Durban that are working for a university in Cape Town, and they would not have dreamt of relocating because they've got families in Durban, but because of this now gradual move towards resident universities to remote work, they are able to work from home. So what's your view in terms of this high staff mobility of this limited talent, academic talent, and the trend with higher education?
Okay, so let me start with the first part of the question, and thank you for the question. So what I'll share is very anecdotal. We haven't really done any systematic surveys on that. I think what was interesting last year, Dr. Kotlan, you're part of our education committee. Just for everyone to know that at the SABP, we have many national committees. One of it is our higher education committee, and that comprises of universities that are accredited by the professional body. And MUT is one of our accredited bodies. Last year, they were the first ones to be accredited virtually. So congratulations again on that. What was interesting last year was the adaptation that the universities, it seemed to me that the university who had already started preparing for it, they were able to launch the digital learning much more quicker and more comfortably than other institutions. And I think what many institutions realize is that providing digital learning is not simply translating what's done in a classroom and recording it and providing a platform. It's much more different. And I think if you look at the debates that were last year, a lot of it is around how we need to support students as well. With some of the academics I interacted, what I found that it depended on the university as well. Some, an individual, some took to digital learning and, you know, the and using digital platforms, Blackboard and the other the platforms that are used to present courses quite well, whereas others not so. So I think it's you know, when we talk about, let me use this example. Now, last year, everyone talked about the great reset, or digital reset. And what we said, you know, it's like not like a switch. It's not like an on and off switch. It's actually preparation that you need to do. So even in organizations, we saw that when they were trying to launch digital learning and remote working, it wasn't an automatic switch. We actually had to put in place support mechanisms and scaffolding to enable that. So my sense is that from what I've seen in the Education Committee, that there was a mixed picture. Some transitioned well and quite quickly. And this year you saw universities, from the feedback we got, much more comfortable. Students are much more comfortable. Even on assessments, virtual assessments, there's comfort there. But again, I think it varies. You need to vary per university and varies per department, I think. So I don't know if I'm giving you a very concrete answer. I don't have one. The second part is in terms of the access to global talent and global platforms. I think here the point is, before we look at, we need to first ask who has that opportunities, especially in our country, we need to look at the digital divide like I talked about. And I think you nailed it on the head, is that the remote work has enabled, open up the world. And that's why I said, you know, in the middle of 2020, everyone saw the potential of digital workspace. At first, there's skepticism, but you saw organizations now realizing, okay, if we open up to the digital workspace, it opens up talent platforms to us and also allows different forms of collaboration and work being done in different ways. So there are opportunities there. I think what you've seen with the digital workplace ramped up and more adoption thereof, you're going to see what we call the war of talents going to get more. The extent of it is going to get more intense. At some point, many people thought we'll go back to 2019. You know, the pandemic will be over and we'll go back to 2019. But a lot of people saying that we're not going to go back to that. And that's why you're seeing probably that people are being poached and they sign off permanent contracts. The other thing is that it comes to what do they want in their lives? I mean, I talked about it earlier, is that individuals are looking at where they see their careers and their skill sets, and it's not now limited to your physical setting. You can take it, for those who have the opportunity, you can take it wherever you want to. So it's going to put a constraint on many, many organizations. So I'm not sure if I've given you a sense of, I know it's not that clear, but I don't think we have a clear-cut answer as yet.
Thanks, AJ.
All right, thank you very much, Doc, for your response. And Dr. Reshma, over to you.
Dr. Kutanana's question covered me, and the response also covered me, but actually on reflection, Dr. AJ, if you could sort of elaborate on the obligations of employers in terms of working from home, and then making return to the physical space mandatory, or vice versa. If you could give us a perspective about what the employer's obligations are.
I haven't seen that. I think we may need to look at, ask for legal advice here, but my sense is that if you look at when you were contracted, and you signed your contract, you will see that many contracts allow for the employer to dictate the workspace and how you work. And that's part of the whole discussion around what is employee, what the individual contractor, or independent worker. Because when you are an employee, you're under the direction of the employer. And that's the whole debate, on a side note, around Uber drivers and, you know, whether Uber drivers are employees or not. It comes from the same grounds today. So at this point, you know, I think it goes back to Ivan's point. I don't think employers are going to do, because they burnt their fingers. If you look at Apple and Google, they burnt their fingers where they said, okay, everyone comes back to office and was mandatory. And then there's a huge backlash. So again, I think it will need consultation. But I think legally or in terms of obligations, I stand to be corrected, but the employer can ask you to return. The site of work that you signed in your contract, I think that's going to be pertinent, and how that contract is defined. And I think that's what everyone is starting to look at, is how are these contracts signed, what does it mean in terms of what is the workplace, what's not the workplace. For example, if we're working remotely, is your home where you're working, is that considered the office? And if you injure yourself in that part of your home, can you claim for an employer? And these are things that are not clarified as yet. I think we're still trying to work through all of these implications. And I don't think there's any fixed answer. But my sense, and this is not legal advice, is that if we look at our contracts, it does give the employer the right to ask us to come back to the office. For example, we look at our contracts, they're quite wide. It enables them to also dictate for you to move from one province to the other. You know, and you have lots of discussions around that, where the employer can ask you to move if they're restructuring all of that. So I think it's a similar case there. So I don't think there's clear answers as yet. I think this is, again, as these cases go to, if it's a CCMA or other labor courts, we'll get some direction coming through from there.
Just as a follow-up on the vice versa now, what about mandating people to work from home? So, what happens there? Like if someone injures themselves on the job but working from home?
Yes, and I haven't seen anything test case on that in terms of any claims. Because, for example, think of it this way, you know, the organization has to provide you with safe equipment. Now, if you think about your laptop, your chair, and so what some organizations did was allowed their employees to take furniture from the office to their home. And some employers also went to the extent where they bought furniture for the employees because they will be a long-term base working from home. So again, I don't think we have clear answers. I think it's something we're going to navigate as cases arise. There's no clear answers as yet. If you listen to HR directors, you'll see that, you know, they're trying to find a way through as they're going along. You know, the whole saying is building the plane while you're flying. And I think that's the case that's happening now. There's no clear answer. So I feel for HR directors because they're looking for direction, but there is none as yet. Similarly, a case like with the mandatory vaccination, I think everyone is hoping that, you know, not hoping, that if discovery was taken to court, that we'd have some direction from the courts, and that will give directions to everyone else in terms of how we interpret the law.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I guess at this point, we just all need to be sensible about vaccination and working from home. And thank you.
Yeah. And I think, Doc, it's about reasonable accommodation. And I think that's in the legislation as well. And if you can show that you've made reasonable accommodation as an employer, I think, I can't give you legal advice. I'm not a lawyer, and I know I have specialization in employment law. But I think the employer can show that they made reasonable accommodation in terms of remote working.
Mm.
In terms of mandatory working at home, that's interesting. I don't think anyone's actually looked at that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ajay, for the response, and thank you, Rashma, for the question. Do we have any comments? I think we are way over time now. Can I give Dr. Duma to give us a vote of thanks, please? Can we see you, Dr. Duma?
Okay. Firstly, I would like to thank everybody who attended this webinar. You made it a success. And I would like to extend my gratitude to our Dean, Dr. Njangase, and our HOD, Dr. Kotelani, for allowing this webinar to happen, to organize it, to this kind of success that we have. And our special thanks goes to our guest speakers, that is Imran and AJ, for sharing with us their time, enlightening us, equipping us for the COVID issues, which are very critical, which forces us, employees and employers, to sit around the table and talk about these issues, because if there is no enough consultation, I think we will not have a good return to work and the vaccination as well. So I would like to thank them for making time. And also, I want to believe that this is not the last one, but it's the beginning of more to come and have a good relationship with MUT. And I would like to wish everybody a good festive season, safe holidays, and vaccinate so that you won't be forced. By the time your employer says you must be vaccinated, then you'll just show them your ID that already I am vaccinated. I have been vaccinated, so do the same. Thank you so much.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.